Yes, sir, answered the president. I have great faith in the people. I believe they will do what is right. Afterwards, the colored delegation published a reply to various points brought up by the president and especially stressed the matter of enmity between the Negroes and the poor whites. The first point to which we feel especially bound to take exception is your attempt to found a policy opposed to our enfranchisement upon the alleged ground of an existing hostility on the part of the former slaves towards the poor white people of the South. We admit the existence of this hostility and hold that it is entirely reciprocal. But you obviously commit an error by drawing an argument from an incident of slavery and making it a basis for a policy adapted to a state of freedom. The hostility between the white and blacks of the South is easily explained. It has its root and sap in the relation of slavery and was incited on both sides by the cunning of the slave masters. Those masters secured their ascendancy over both the poor whites and blacks by putting enmity between them. They divided both to conquer each. There was no earthly reason why the blacks should not hate and dread the poor whites when in a state of slavery, for it was from this class that their masters received their slave catchers, slave drivers, and overseers. They were the men called in upon all occasions by the masters whenever any fiendish outrage was to be committed upon the slave. Now, sir, you cannot but perceive that the cause of this hatred removed, the effect must be removed also. Slavery is abolished. The cause of this antagonism is removed. And you must see that it is altogether illogical and putting new wine into old bottles to legislate from slaveholding premises for a people whom you have repeatedly declared it your purpose to maintain in freedom. Besides, even if it were true, as you allege, that the hostility of the blacks towards the poor whites must necessarily project itself into a state of freedom, and that this enmity between the two races is even more intense in a state of freedom than in a state of slavery, in the name of heaven, we reverently ask, how can you, in view of your professed desire to promote the welfare of the black man, deprive him of all means of defense, and clothe him whom you regard as his enemy in the panoply of political power? Can it be that you recommend policy which would arm the strong and cast down the defenseless? Can you, by any possibility of reasoning, regard this as just, fair, or wise? Experience proves that those are most abused who can be abused with the greatest impunity. On the colonization theory you were pleased to broach, very much could be said. It is impossible to suppose, in view of the usefulness of the black man in times of peace as a laborer in the South, and in time of war as a soldier in the North, and the growing respect for his rights among the people and his increasing adaptation to a high state of civilization in his native land, that there can ever come a time when he can be removed from this country without a terrible shock to its prosperity and peace. The Committee of 15 began its work again. The indomitable Stevens never gave up, never despaired. If he could not get all he wanted, he stood fast and took what he could. He said, sadly, June 13, 1866, in the House of Representatives, referring to the proposed 14th Amendment with its permission to disfranchise the Negro, "In my youth, in my manhood, in my old age, I had fondly dreamed that when any fortunate chance should have broken up for a while the foundation of our institutions and released us from obligations the most tyrannical that ever man imposed in the name of freedom, that the intelligent, pure, and just men of this republic, true to their professions and their consciences, would have so remodeled all our institutions as to have freed them from every vestige of human oppression, of inequality of rights, of the recognized degradation of the poor and the superior caste of the rich. In short, that no distinction would be tolerated in this purified republic but what arose from merit and conduct. This bright dream has vanished like the baseless fabric of a vision. I find that we shall be obliged to be content with patching up the worst portions of the ancient edifice and leaving it, in many of its parts, to be swept through by the tempests, frosts, and the storms of despotism. Do you inquire why, holding these views and possessing some will of my own, I accept so imperfect a proposition? I answer because I live among men, and not among angels. Among men as intelligent, as determined, and as independent as myself, who, not agreeing with me, do not choose to yield up their opinions to mine. Mutual concessions is our only resort, or mutual hostilities. The Committee of 15 now tried to find out by actual inquiry just what the situation in the South was with regard to the Negro. It did this not so much because anyone was in doubt, as because the situation of the Negro was the most appealing thing that could be used to bring a majority to vote for the industrial North. It would increase the tremendous moral afflatus which made the war more and more symbolic in the minds of the people of the United States of a great triumph of human freedom. Subcommittees of the main committee took testimony for months all over the South and eventually issued an unanswerable array of evidence. April 20th, Robert Dale Owen brought a proposal for a 14th Amendment to Stevens in the Committee of 15. Stevens picked up my manuscript, looked it carefully over, and then, in his impulsive way, said, "I'll be plain with you, Owen. We've had nothing before us that comes anywhere near being as good as this, or as complete. It would be likely to pass, too. That's the best of it. We haven't had a majority, either in our committee or in Congress, for immediate suffrage, and I don't believe the states have yet advanced so far that they would be willing to ratify it. I'll lay that amendment of yours before our committee tomorrow, if you say so, and I'll do my best to put it through." Previous to this time, the thought was to bring in several separate amendments, but now the attitude was to unite the whole matter in one comprehensive amendment so that the proposition of April 21st was presented as follows. Section 1. No discrimination shall be made by any state, nor by the United States, as to the civil rights of persons because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Section 2. From and after the fourth day of July, in the year 1876, no discrimination shall be made by any state, nor by the United States, as to the enjoyment of classes of persons of the right of suffrage because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Section 3. Until the fourth day of July, 1876, no class of persons, as to the right of any of whom to suffrage discrimination, shall be made by any state because of race, color, or previous condition of servitude, shall be included in the basis of representation. Section 4. Debts incurred in aid of insurrection or of war against the Union, and claims of compensation for loss of involuntary service or labor, shall not be paid by any state, nor by the United States. Bingham moved a fifth section to the amendment along the lines of his previous efforts. Section 5. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The Bingham proposal was first adopted and then struck out by the committee. It was voted 7-6 to report the first three sections to Congress. Bingham tried in vain to bring in his proposal as a separate amendment. Thus, Owen's proposition was ordered, sent to Congress, and had a good chance of being adopted. But Fessenden, the chairman, was sick with varioloid, and it was decided to delay final report until he was better. Stevens told Owens the sequel. "Our action on your amendment," said Stevens, "had, it seems, gotten noised abroad. In the course of last week, the members from New York, from Illinois, and from your state too, Owen, from Indiana, held each separately a caucus to consider whether equality of suffrage, present or prospective, ought to form a part of the Republican program for the coming canvass. They were afraid, so some of them told us, that if there was a nigger in the woodpile at all, that was the phrase, it would be used against them as an electioneering handle, and some of them, hang their cowardice, might lose their elections. By inconsiderable majorities, each of these caucuses decided that Negro suffrage in any shape ought to be excluded from the platform, and they communicated these decisions to us. Our committee hadn't backbone enough to maintain its ground. Yesterday, the vote on your plan was reconsidered. Your amendment was laid on the table, and in the course of the next 3 hours, we contrived to patch together, well, what you've read this morning. The sections were changed so as simply to exclude disfranchised Negroes from being made the basis of apportionment. Williams then presented a new section which allowed the Negroes gradually to be enfranchised and thus gradually to become a basis of representation. Representatives shall be apportioned among several states, which may be included within this union, according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But whenever in any state, the elective franchise shall be denied to any portion of its male citizens, not less than 21 years of age, or in any way abridged, except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation in such state shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens, not less than 21 years of age. This was adopted as Section 2 of the final amendment. Finally, on this same date, the committee reinserted, by a vote of 10-3, Bingham's proposition on civil rights as Section 1. Afterward, Conkling, before the Supreme Court, explained this action. At the time the 14th Amendment was ratified, individuals and joint stock companies were appealing for congressional and administrative protection against the invidious and discriminating state and local taxes. One instance was that of an express company, whose stock was owned largely by citizens of the state of New York, who came with petitions and bills seeking acts of Congress to aid them in resisting what they deemed oppressive taxation in two states, and oppressive and ruinous rules of damages applied under state laws, that complaints of oppression in respect of property and other rights made by citizens of northern states who took up residence in the South were rife in and out of Congress. The committee then considered Section 3. Mr. Harris moved to insert the following. Until the 4th of July in the year 1870, all persons who voluntarily adhered to the late insurrection, giving it aid and comfort, shall be excluded from the right to vote for representatives in Congress and for electors for President and Vice President of the United States. This was finally adopted by a vote of 8-7. The committee then discussed the readmission of the Southern states with the 14th Amendment as a condition. Finally, the joint resolution and the bill concerning the readmission of the Southern states were adopted by a vote of 12-3. This proposed amendment and bill were reported to the House April 30th, debated May 8th, 9th, and 10th, and passed May 10th. Stevens defended it May 8th and May 10th. Our fathers had been compelled to postpone the principles of their great declaration and wait for their full establishment until a more propitious time. That time ought to be present now. But the public mind has been educated in error for a century. How difficult in a day to unlearn it! In rebuilding, it is necessary to clear away the rotten and defective portions of the old foundations, and to sink deep and found the unrepaired edifice upon the firm foundation of eternal justice. If perchance the accumulated quicksands render it impossible to reach in every part so firm a basis, then it becomes our duty to drive deep and solid the substituted piles on which to build. It would not be wise to prevent the raising of the structure because some corner of it might decay. It were better to shelter the household and trust to the advancing progress of a higher morality and a purer and more intelligent principle to underpin the defective corner. This proposition is not all that the committee desired. It falls far short of my wishes, but it fulfills my hopes. I believe it is all that can be obtained in the present state of public opinion. Not only Congress, but several states are to be consulted. Upon a careful survey of the whole ground, we did not believe that 19 of the loyal states could be induced to ratify any proposition more stringent than this. I say 19, for I utterly repudiate and scorn the idea that any state not acting in the Union is to be counted on the question of ratification. It is absurd to suppose that any more than 3/4 of the states that propose the amendment are required to make it valid, that states not here are to be counted as present. Believing, then, that this is the best proposition that can be made effectual, I accept it. I shall not be driven by clamor or denunciation to throw away a great cause because it is not perfect. I will take all I can get in the cause of humanity and leave it to be perfected by better men in better times. It may be that that time will not come while I am here to enjoy the glorious triumph. But that it will come is as certain as there is a just God. Stevens then referred to the previous draft of the amendment. After having received the careful examination and approbation of the committee, and having received the united Republican vote of 120 representatives of the people, it was denounced as utterly reprehensible and unpardonable, to be encountered as a public enemy, positively endangering the peace of the country and covering its name with dishonor. A wickedness on a larger scale than the crime against Kansas or the fugitive slave law. Gross, foul, outrageous, an incredible injustice against the whole African race, with every other vulgar epithet which polished cultivation could command. I confess my mortification at its defeat. I grieved especially because it almost closed the door of hope for the amelioration of the condition of the freedmen. But men in pursuit of justice must never despair. Let us again try and see whether we cannot devise some way to overcome the united forces of self-righteous Republicans and unrighteous copperheads. It will not do for those who for 30 years have fought the beasts at Ephesus to be frightened by the fangs of modern catamounts. Thaddeus Stevens continued his speech. May 10th. Let not these friends of secession sing to me their siren song of peace and goodwill until they can stop my ears to the screams and groans of the dying victims at Memphis. I hold in my hand an elaborate account from a man whom I know to be the highest respectability in the country, every word of which I believe. This account of that foul transaction only reached me last night. It is more horrible in its atrocity, although not to the same extent, than the massacre at Jamaica. Tell me, Tennessee, or any other state, is loyal of whom such things are proved. Ah, sir, it is but 6 years ago when they were here, just before they went out to join the armies of Catiline, just before they left this hall. Those of you who were here then will remember the scene in which every Southern member, encouraged by their allies, came forth in one yelling body because a speech for freedom was being made here. When weapons were drawn and Barksdale's Bowie knife gleamed before our eyes. Would you have these men back again so soon to reenact those scenes? Wait until I am gone, I pray you. I want not to go through it again. It will be but a short time for my colleagues to wait. Now, sir, if the gentleman had remembered the scenes 20 years ago, when no man dared to speak without risking his life, when but a few men did do it, for there were cowards in those days, as there are in these, you would not have found them asking to bring these men in. And I only wonder that my friend from Ohio, Mr. Bingham, should intimate a desire to bring them here. The announcement of the vote, May 10th, was 128 237. 19 not voting. It was received with applause on the floor and in the galleries. Mr. Eldridge of Wisconsin rose angrily to a question of order. I want to know if it is understood that the proceedings of this House are to be interrupted by those who come here and occupy the galleries. The gentleman from Wisconsin, replied the Speaker, makes the point of order that expressions of approbation or disapprobation from the persons occupying the galleries are not in order. The chair sustains the point of order. But Mr. Eldridge was still angry. I do not want our proceedings to be interrupted by the niggerheads in the galleries. The galleries hissed, and Stevens asked, Is it in order for members on the floor to disturb those in the galleries? Members upon the floor should not insult the spectators in the galleries, said the Speaker. The 14th Amendment came up in the Senate April 30th, but Fessenden was still ill, and no action was taken for 2 weeks. Finally, May 23rd, Howard of Michigan began the debate. He declared that the object of the 14th Amendment was primarily to give Congress the power to enforce the guarantees of freedom in the first 8 amendments to the Constitution. The West, led by Sherman, Doolittle, and others, tried to reinduce voters as the basis of representation. New England, though Senator Wilson of Massachusetts, was opposed to striking from the basis of representation 2,100,000 unnaturalized foreigners who gave the North 17 representatives. Sherman did not agree. If it is right to exclude 4 millions of blacks in the southern states who are denied representation, is it not also right to exclude all other classes in every other state who are denied political power? The question of Negro citizenship was discussed, and Julian of Indiana opposed the conservative stand. To follow conservatism, we would recognize the revolting states as still in the Union. It opposes the protection of the millions of loyal colored people of the South through the agency of the Freedmen's Bureau. It opposes the Civil Rights Bill. It opposes with all bitterness the policy of giving the freedmen the ballot. On the other hand, radicalism would hold treason a crime. It would base representation on the actual voters. It favors the protection of the colored people of the South through the Freedmen's Bureau and the Civil Rights Bill. It demands the ballot as the right of every colored citizen. Evidently, the breach between the East and West was growing, and coupled with Sumner's attitude, it looked as though the 14th Amendment was again doomed. The Republican Party fell back upon the caucus. From May 24th to May 28th, the Senate was in session but a few hours, which gave the Republicans time to discuss the whole matter in party caucus. The party at that time showed clear division into conservative, industrial elements like Fessenden, Trumbull, and Morgan, and the abolition democracy led by Sumner, Wade, and Yates. The opposition of Sumner and the abolition democracy was finally overcome by the plain facts of the case. This was the utmost that could be got from Congress in defense of democracy. Was it not worth taking? What could be hoped for in further delay? As a result of the caucuses, certain amendments were made. The second section was amended to strike out the word citizen and insert inhabitants being citizens of the United States. A new first section was inserted. That all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of states wherein they reside. The Senate's changes thus consisted in defining who were citizens and in substituting for disfranchisement of all participants in secession until 1870 the ineligibility of certain high officials. It opened the elector franchise to such persons as the states may choose to admit, and adopted the third section in its present form. We have thus followed, as well as records led us, the inner history of the Reconstruction measures of Congress in the Committee of 15 and other sources. Now let us look at the proceedings of Congress as negotiations on these matters rose among the leaders, here and there and now and then, in a sea of struggling, unorganized action. In the matter of civil rights, the final draft of the 14th Amendment said, All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. The first proposition on civil rights was introduced into the House by Mr. Stevens, December 5, 1865. On December 6, Bingham of Ohio offered an amendment. Both these resolutions went to the Committee on the Judiciary. Two other propositions were introduced December 11th. February 1, 1866, a motion was passed directing the Committee of 15 to inquire into this matter. William suggested an amendment, February 5th, empowering Congress to enforce all obligations, prohibitions, or disabilities imposed by the Constitution on the several states. February 13, 1866, the Committee of 15, as we have noted, reported to both houses a proposed amendment by Mr. Bingham in the House and by Mr. Fessenden in the Senate. Both motions were indefinitely postponed, and there was a strong desire to get the whole final report of the Committee of 15. On March 9, 1866, while the Senate was discussing the apportionment of representatives, Senator Yates of Illinois moved an amendment for civil and political rights, but it secured only 7 votes. Two other and similar propositions were made in the Senate, but received small support. The first section of the resolution reported to the House April 30, 1866, became eventually the civil rights section of the 14th Amendment passed by the House. But the Senate, as we have seen, did not adopt it. Several attempts were made to amend it in the Senate. Mr. Wade offered a substitute for the entire resolution, but the whole proposition failed. When the second proposition came before the Senate May 30th, Howard of Michigan, in behalf of Senate members of the Joint Committee, presented a series of resolutions which had been adopted by the Republican caucus as a substitute for the House amendment. The substitute was accepted. The first change was to prefix these words to the first clause of the amendment: "All persons born in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside." Later, Fessenden of Maine secured the inclusion of naturalized persons. Senator Johnson of Maryland tried unsuccessfully to strike out the guarantee that states should not make or enforce any law to abridge the privileges of immunity of citizens. Disability for participation in secession was covered by Section 3. No person shall be a senator or representative in Congress, or elector of president and vice president, or hold any office, civil or military, under the United States, or under any state, who, having previously taken an oath as a member of Congress, or as an officer of the United States, or as a member of any state legislature, or as an executive or judicial officer of any state, to support the Constitution of the United States, shall have engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the same, or given aid or comfort to the enemies thereof. But Congress may, by a vote of 2/3 of each House, remove such disability. 4 amendments on disabilities for participation in the rebellion were introduced in 1866. In the report of the Committee of 15, April 30, 1866, there was included a 3rd section by which all persons who voluntarily adhered to the late insurrection were excluded from the right to vote until July 4, 1870. Attempts were made to amend this in the House. When the resolution reached the Senate, there were 15 attempts to alter this section. On May 30th, Senator Howard of Michigan, in behalf of the Senate members of the Joint Committee on Reconstruction, presented a new draft in which he proposed, in place of the 3rd section, the provision which now appears in the 14th Amendment. Many efforts were made to amend it. The Democratic senators seemed to prefer the Howard substitute to the House amendment. This section passed. The question of suffrage for Negroes was covered by Section 2. Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed. But when the right to vote at any election for the choice of electors for President and Vice President of the United States, representatives in Congress, the executive or judicial officers of a state, or the members of the legislature thereof, is denied to any of the male inhabitants of such states, being 21 years of age, and citizens of the United States, or in any way abridged, except for participation in rebellion or other crime, the basis of representation therein shall be reduced in the proportion which the number of such male citizens shall bear to the whole number of male citizens 21 years of age in such state. This question of Negro suffrage gave rise to 5 proposed amendments just before the Civil War. All these excluded persons of Negro descent from the right to vote, and most of them excluded from them the right to hold office. In the opening days of the 39th Congress, there were 6 propositions to guarantee the right to vote to Negroes. 2 proposed an educational standard in voting for federal officials. Boutwell proposed an amendment making unlawful any distinction in the elective franchise on account of race or color. Another amendment proposed to give Congress power to define the qualifications of voters and members of Congress and of presidential electors. Henderson, January 23, 1866, proposed an amendment denying the state the right to discriminate against voters on account of race or color. January 22, 1866, the proposal on the apportionment of representatives and abridgment of representatives was presented by the Committee of 15 to the House. It was recommitted January 29th and reported again January 31st. It passed January 31st. In the Senate, there were 5 attempts to amend this resolution. Sumner presented a resolution making color discrimination impossible in the courtroom or ballot box. This was rejected 39-8. Howard proposed to admit to the franchise Negroes in the Army and Navy, or those able to read and write, or those who had property to the value of $250. This was not acted on. Sumner again attempted to amend the resolution by making illegal discrimination on account of race and color. It was lost 39-8. A similar proposal by Yates of Illinois was rejected. 3 other propositions to amend the Constitution relative to the suffrage were introduced before the close of this Congress. One was a proposition by Stewart of Nevada on March 16th. This foreshadowed the subsequent Grandfather Clause. It admitted the Southern states on several conditions, one of which was the extension of the elective franchise to all persons upon the same terms and conditions, making no discrimination on account of race, color, or previous condition of servitude. Provided that those who were qualified to vote in the year 1860 by the laws of their respective states shall not be disfranchised by reason of any new tests or conditions which have been or may be prescribed since that year. That when the aforementioned condition shall have been complied with and ratified by a majority of the present voting population, a general amnesty shall be proclaimed. That all the loyal states be respectively requested to incorporate in their constitutions an amendment corresponding to the one above described. That it is not intended to assert a coercive power on the part of Congress in regard to the regulation of the suffrage in the different states, but only to make an appeal to their own good sense and love of country with a view to the prevention of serious evils now threatened. Seward said in 1870, "When the Reconstruction question arose about the 14th Amendment, I proposed that all persons born in the United States after the date of Mr. Lincoln's proclamation abolishing slavery should be entitled to vote on arriving at the age of 21 years, and this should enter into Reconstruction." The resolution for the new 14th Amendment passed the Senate June 8, 1866, by a vote of 33-11, 5 members not voting. The amended resolution was brought before the House and was called up June 13th. After a limited debate, the amendments made by the Senate were concurred in by a vote of 120-32, 32 not voting. Thus, the 14th Amendment was sent to the states for approval. After the President's veto of the Freedmen's Bureau Bill, Many members wanted the question immediately reconsidered, and the day after the president's speech of February 22nd, Senator Wilson introduced a bill which was not reported. The legislatures of several states approved of a bill by petitions which urged maintaining the Bureau. The president tried to counteract this by sending two agents, Generals Steedman and Fullerton, to investigate the Bureau. They were both in sympathy with this policy and made a tour of 4 months. They commended Howard and believed that the Bureau had done much to preserve order and organize free labor, but that it had sometimes been dishonestly and injudiciously administered, and that it was time for it to come to an end. This report was widely circulated and discussed. The charges were investigated, and public confidence in the Bureau was shaken. Nevertheless, May 22nd, a bill to continue the Bureau was introduced. It differed from the bill of February 9th in limiting the Bureau to 2 years. Land held under Sherman's orders was to be restored to former owners, and other land furnished the dispossessed freedmen. Army officers were retained in the service of the Bureau, and commissioners were authorized to cooperate with agents of benevolent associations. Property was to be appropriated for the education of the freedmen, and military protection of their civil rights guaranteed. After discussion, the bill passed to the House May 29th by a vote of 96-32. In the Senate, the bill was amended and a conference was held. The conference agreed that the questions arising out of Sherman's orders should be left entirely with the president for settlement. On June 16th, the president vetoed the bill and called the Freedmen's Bureau a proposition to transfer 4 million slaves from their original owners to a new set of taskmasters. By a severe exercise of party discipline, according to Blaine, the necessary two-thirds vote was procured in each house, and the bill passed over the president's veto on the same day that it was received. Thus, government guardianship of freedmen was given a temporary extension under a grudging and partly inimical administration. The disposition of Congress to yield, in part to the president, was manifest. On June 6th, the Committee of 15 was reappointed. Subcommittees had been taking testimony all over the South. The final report of the Committee of 15 was made June 18th. It made an 800-page book, and 100,000 copies were distributed. Its majority and minority sections summed up the strongest arguments available for and against the proposed methods of Reconstruction. The part of the majority report that touched the Negro said, "Slavery has been abolished by constitutional amendment. A large proportion of the population had become, instead of mere chattels, free men and citizens. Through all the past struggle, these had remained true and loyal, and had, in large numbers, fought on the side of the Union. It was impossible to abandon them without securing them their rights as free men and citizens. The whole civilized world would have cried out against such base ingratitude, and the bare idea is offensive to all right-thinking men. Hence, it became important to inquire what could be done to secure their rights, civil and political. It was evident to your committee that adequate security could only be found in appropriate constitutional provisions. The increase of representation necessarily resulting from the abolition of slavery was considered the most important element in the questions arising out of the changed condition of affairs, and the necessity for some fundamental action in this regard seemed imperative. It appeared to your committee that the rights of these persons by whom the basis of representation had been thus increased should be recognized by the general government. While slaves, they were not considered as having any rights, civil or political. It did not seem just or proper that all the political advantages derived from their becoming free should be confined to their former masters who had fought against the Union and withheld from themselves who had always been loyal. Doubts were entertained whether Congress had power, even under the amended Constitution, to prescribe the qualifications of voters in a state or could act directly on the subject. It was doubtful, in the opinion of your committee, whether the states would consent to surrender a power they had always exercised and to which they were attached. As the best, if not the only, method of surmounting the difficulty, and as eminently just and proper in itself, your committee came to the conclusion that political power should be possessed in all the states, exactly in proportion as the right of suffrage should be granted without distinction of color or race. It appears quite clear that the anti-slavery amendments both to the state and federal constitutions were adopted in the South with reluctancy by the bodies which did adopt them, while in some states they have been either passed by in silence or rejected. The language of all the provisions and ordinances of these states on the subject amounts to nothing more than an unwilling admission of an unwelcome truth. Looking still further at the evidence taken by your committee, it is found to be clearly shown, by witnesses of the highest character and having the best means of observation, that the Freedmen's Bureau, instituted for the relief and protection of freedmen and refugees, is almost universally opposed by the mass of the population, and exists in an efficient condition only under military protection, while the Union men of the South are earnest in its defense, declaring with one voice that without its protection, the colored people would not be permitted to labor at fair prices and could hardly live in safety. They also testify that without the protection of United States troops, Union men, whether of Northern or Southern origin, would be obliged to abandon their homes. The feeling in many portions of the country towards the emancipated slaves, especially among the uneducated and ignorant, is one of vindictive and malicious hatred. This deep-seated prejudice against color is assiduously cultivated by the public journals and leads to acts of cruelty, oppression, and murder, which the local authorities are at no pains to prevent or punish. There is no general disposition to place the colored race, constituting at least two-fifths of the population, upon terms even of civil equality, while many instances may be found where large planters of men of the better class accepted the situation and honestly strive to bring about a better order of things by employing the freedmen at fair wages and treating them kindly. The general feeling and disposition among all classes are yet totally averse to the toleration of any class of people friendly to the Union, be they white or black, and this aversion is not infrequently manifested in an insulting and offensive manner. This part of the report was signed by 12 members of the committee. The other three members submitted a minority report. It was, in the main, the old metaphysical argument signed by Johnson, the constitutional lawyer from Maryland, Rogers, the extreme advocate of Southern rights from New Jersey, and Grider. They are asked to disfranchise a numerous class of their citizens, and also to agree to diminish their representation in Congress, and of course in the Electoral College, or to admit to the right of suffrage their colored males of 21 years of age and upwards, a class now in a condition of almost utter ignorance, thus placing them on the same political footing with white citizens of that age. For reasons so obvious that the dullest may discover them, the right is not directly asserted of granting suffrage to the Negro. That would be obnoxious to most of the northern and western states, so much so that their consent was not to be anticipated. But as the plan adopted, because of the limited number of Negroes in such states, will have no effect on their representation, it is thought it may be adopted, while in the southern states it will materially lessen their number. That these latter states will assent to the measure can hardly be expected. The effect, then, if not the purpose of the measure, is forever to deny representatives to such states, or if they consent to the condition, to weaken their representative power, and thus, probably, secure a continuance of such a party in power as now controls the legislation of the government. The measure in its terms and its effect, whether designed or not, is to degrade the southern states. To consent to it will be to consent to their own dishonor. Neither Sumner nor Stevens was satisfied with the 14th Amendment. On the last day of the session, July 28, 1866, Thaddeus Stevens made his last defense of Negro suffrage. He was, at the time, worn out. His health was precarious. He was 73 years of age, and he hardly expected to return to his seat in the House. With deep solemnity, he sought to make one more, perhaps an expiring, effort to do something which shall be useful to my fellow men, something to elevate and enlighten the poor, the oppressed, and the ignorant in this great crisis of human affairs. The black man, he declared, must have the ballot, or he would continue to be a slave. There was some alleviation to the lot of a bondman, but a freeman, deprived of every human rights, is the most degraded of human beings. Without the protection of the ballot box, the freedmen were the mere serfs, and would become the victims of their former masters. He declared that what he had done for humanity. "I know it is easy," he said, "to protect the interests of the rich and powerful, but it is great labor to guard the rights of the poor and downtrodden. It is the eternal labor of Sisyphus, forever to be renewed. In this, perhaps my final action on this great question, I can see nothing in my political course, especially in regard to human freedom, which I could wish to have expunged or changed. I believe that we must all account hereafter for deeds done in the body, and that political deeds will be among those accounts. I desire to take to the bar of that final settlement the record which I shall this day make on the great question of human rights. While I am sure it will not make atonement for half my errors, I hope it will be some palliation. Are there any who will venture to take the list with their negative seal upon it, and who will dare to unroll it before that stern judge who is the father of the immortal beings whom they have been trampling underfoot, and whose souls they have been crushing out?" This was not, in fact, his last speech, but it had the tone of a final message. Congress adjourned before a congressional plan of reconstruction reached its final form, but its general outline was clear, and no further compromise between the congressional majority and Johnson was possible. Already, the president's attitude on the 14th Amendment and Reconstruction had led to two suicides, the resignation of three members of the cabinet, and although Stanton remained, his retention caused the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. Sumner, much against his will, had remained silent when the Senate, by party caucus, had decided upon the 14th Amendment. On the last day of Congress, he wrote the Duchess of Argyll. "The suffering at the South is great through the misconduct of the president. His course has kept the rebel spirit alive and depressed the loyal, white and black. It makes me very sad to see this. Considering the difficulties of their position, the blacks have done wonderfully well. They should have a Moses as a president. But they had found a Pharaoh. Particularly had the situation in Louisiana become tense. The New Orleans riot of July 30, 1866, confirmed the abolitionists in their opinion that the reconstructed states were in the power of the rebels, and that they were using their power to put the Negro back into slavery, and that no man, white or black, who was friendly to the Union was safe in the South. There were reported 1,000 murders in the South, with few of the criminals brought to justice, and the country was convinced that the president had disrupted the Union Party and was conspiring with Democrats, North and South, to drive out the Republicans. In the election of 1866, there was on the side of Congress a Union Party with a center block of Republicans, a left wing of radical abolitionists, and a right wing of reactionary war Democrats. Andrew Johnson tried to unite the Western radicals and the war Democrats into a new third party, to be reinforced eventually by the returned secessionists. But between extreme democracy and reaction, there was no common ground. He only succeeded in getting the support of a few of the war Democrats and the Copperheads, who were either Southerners living north or Northern men with Southern principles. State and national conventions met. Johnson and his friends started out August 14th to form a Johnson Party. The National Union Convention met in Philadelphia, with states North and South represented. A special wigwam, two stories high, was erected on Girard Avenue, seating 10,000 people. The interior was decorated with flags. Horace Greeley called it a bread-and-butter convention composed of 99% of rebels and copperheads. Thomas Nast ridiculed the convention in his cartoons in Harper's Weekly. Their declaration of principles, accepted unanimously, declared the war had maintained the Constitution and the Union unaltered, and that neither Congress nor the general government had any authority to deny the constitutional right of congressional representation to any state. They urged the election of congressmen who would admit all loyal representatives from the South. They affirmed the inability of a state either to secede or exclude any other state from the Union, and the constitutional right of each state to decide for itself the qualifications for voting within its borders. They insisted that the Constitution could not be legally amended, except with all the states voting in Congress, and action by all the legislatures. They denied any desire in the southern states to restore slavery. They proclaimed the invalidity of the rebel debts, the inviolability of the federal debt, and the right of freedmen to the same protection of persons and property as afforded to whites. They urged government aid for federal soldiers and their families. Finally, they expressed wholehearted endorsement of Andrew Johnson. The weakness of this meeting was that, first, it contained, in facts, few Republicans, most of the delegates being well-known Democrats who had opposed Lincoln. It was dubbed the Conference of Copperheads, and among the delegates were Vallandigham and Fernando Wood. Secondly, the meeting was not followed up with careful organization. No sooner had this convention adjourned than Southern Loyalists met in Philadelphia on September 3rd to confer with Northern Republicans, including Horace Greeley, John Jacob Astor, Carl Schurz, Frederick Douglass, Brownlow, Thomas E. Benton, Morton, Cameron, and Gerry. This conference met in two parts, one Northern and one Southern. Frederick Douglass was elected delegate from Rochester to attend the convention. It was a great honor for a black man in a white city. On the train, he met Southern and Western delegates, including Governor Oliver P. Morton of Indiana. After consultation, a committee waited on him and, through a Louisiana spokesman, insisted on their high respect for him, but also on their fear that it was inexpedient for him to attend the convention on account of the cry of social and political equality which would be raised against the Republican Party. Douglass replied, "Gentlemen, with all respect, you might as well ask me to put a loaded pistol to my head and blow my brains out as to ask me to keep out of this convention to which I have been duly elected." He pointed out that the fact of his election was widely known, and his failure to attend would be inexplicable. Later, he was warned against walking in the procession, and for a while it looked as if he would have to walk alone, until Theodore Tilton of New York offered to walk with him. In that parade, he met a daughter of his former owner. During the convention, Speed, who had just resigned from the cabinet, called the president a tyrant, and the Southern Loyalists attacked Johnson, but split on Negro suffrage. A part of the convention finally adopted this declaration: "The government by national and appropriate legislation, enforced by national authority, shall confer on every citizen in the states we represent the American birthright of impartial suffrage and equality before the law. This is the one all-sufficient remedy. This is our great and pressing necessity." Governor Brownlow of Tennessee, in discussing Negro suffrage at this same convention on September 3, 1866, said, "Some gentlemen, from a mistaken view of my character, said they were afraid of Negro suffrage and wanted to dodge it. I have never dodged any subject, nor have I ever been found on both sides of any subject. While I am satisfied with everything done here, I would go further. I am an advocate of Negro suffrage and impartial suffrage. I would rather associate with loyal Negroes than with disloyal white men. I would rather be buried in a Negro graveyard than in a rebel graveyard, and after death I would sooner go to a Negro heaven than a white rebel's hell." There followed in September two military conventions, one in Cleveland, September 18th, by Friends of Johnson, which did not mention Negro suffrage. It denounced the abolitionists and said that they were trying to force another war. It contained many Democrats and a few conservative Republicans. Confederate officers at Memphis, including General Forrest of Fort Pillow fame, sent sympathy by telegram, which was unfortunate publicity. In answer to this, a national convention of citizens, soldiers, and sailors was held at Pittsburgh September 25th and 26th. There were many volunteer officers of high rank, and Johnson was denounced, and the 14th Amendment advocated. This convention had great influence on public opinion and popularized the 14th Amendment. The issue in the election of the fall of 1866 turned on whether Congress should recognize Southern states as reconstructed by Johnson. It was not a presidential year, but congressmen and state legislatures were to be elected. The real campaign began in August, with the 14th of August convention in Philadelphia. This convention greatly encouraged Johnson, and he wrote it, attacking Congress for preventing the restoration of peace and union, and denying that it was really a legal Congress. If I had wanted authority, or if I had wished to perpetuate my own power, how easily could I have held and wielded that which was placed in my hands by the measure called Freedmen's Bureau Bill? On July 4th, he had issued another proclamation of general amnesty, and on August 20th, he declared the Civil War at an end. Already in the spring, he had promised to lay the cornerstone of a monument to Stephen A. Douglas in Chicago, and he left Washington August 28th on a great campaign tour, which was to sweep the country. He took General Grant with him, and members of his cabinet, and Seward joined him in New York. Johnson stopped at Philadelphia, New York, Albany, and then went west by way of Cleveland, Chicago, and St. Louis. It was an extraordinary and increasingly painful effort by which Johnson definitely defeated himself and his own political policies. He showed genius for saying the wrong thing. In New York, for instance, he asked, "Are we prepared, after the cost of war, to continue the disrupted condition of the country? Why are we afraid of the representatives of the South? Some have grown fat, some have grown rich by the aggression and destruction of others." In Philadelphia, he declared that God was a tailor, like himself. At Cleveland, his audience became a mob, while the president himself increased the hubbub. The city authorities had made preparations for a polite reception, but as he proceeded with his harangue, the mob took complete possession of the crowd. Someone cried, "Why not hang Thad Stevens and Wendell Phillips?" "Yes," yelled Johnson, "why not hang them?" Some towns hung out black flags and banners. "No welcome to traitors." Bands played the death march. Johnson shouted in defiance. His egotism was ridiculed. He was charged with being drunk, a traitor, and a demagogue. On he reeled. As Burgess said, the trip degraded the presidential office. The New York Tribune watched it with a feeling of national shame and called it the stumbling tour of an inebriated demagogue. The New York World excused him by asking who of all presidents had been lower than Lincoln in personal bearing. The Herald put the blame on Seward's shoulders, the Mephistopheles of the administration. Lowell called the journey an indecent orgy. Rhodes says he was intoxicated at Cleveland, while Schuyler declares he was sober. The culmination came in St. Louis, where Johnson declared that the blood of the New Orleans riot was on Congress and decried the diabolical and nefarious policies of Stevens, Phillips, and Sumner. The most charitable thing that the defenders of Andrew Johnson can say of him is that occasionally he got drunk. For too much liquor alone would excuse such extraordinary conduct and performances as his vice presidential inauguration, his speech of February 22, 1866, his exhibition at Cleveland, and his St. Louis debauch. If he was not an occasional drunkard, he was God's own fool. He returned to Washington, as Schurz says, an utterly discomfited and disgraced man, having gone out to win popular support and having earned only public disgust. The role of Seward during this episode was pathetic. One of the wits of the time spoke of Seward's new office of bear leader. Unfortunately, he was very unsuccessful even in this task, for he could do little more than apologize for Johnson and, in a few commonplace sentences, call upon the audience to support the president in opposition to Congress. At Niagara, he told the crowd that Lincoln had been traduced when alive. But after his assassination, all hearts inclined to the deepest sorrow, and it would be the same if Johnson should be taken off. To the citizens of Buffalo, he stated the issue as follows. The question is between the president and the Congress. Of all that has been done to bring us so near the consummation of Reconstruction, you see that nothing has been done that was not done through the direction, agency, activity, perseverance, and patriotism of Andrew Johnson, President of the United States. Will you stand by Congress, or will you stand by the President? The Republicans took every advantage of the situation. They saw in Johnson an instinct of the poor white cropping out. He cannot shake off the bootlicking proclivity born and bred in him towards the aristocracy of the South. Miserable fool. Stevens made but one speech in the campaign of 1866. He said that he had been directed by his physician neither to think, speak, nor read until the next session of Congress, that he had followed the orders not to read almost literally. It is true, I have amused myself with a little light frivolous reading. For instance, there was a serial account from day to day of a very remarkable circus that traveled through the country from Washington to Chicago and St. Louis, and from Louisville back to Washington. I read that with some interest, expecting to see in so celebrated an establishment one which from its heralding was to beat Dan Rice and all the old circuses that ever went forth. I expected great wit from the celebrated character of its clowns. As the campaign of 1866 progressed, the agitation in favor of granting suffrage to the Negro as a necessary protection of his freedom became marked. First of all, industry and trade were convinced that they could not trust the white South. Therefore, the more extreme ideas which Stevens had advocated were allowed to be broadcast. Their logic was strong and their methods popular. People had faith in laws and wanted some great enactment in keeping with the greatness of the war. It was a ripe time for amending the Constitution and inaugurating final reforms. These reforms might be in advance at the time, but they were worth trying, and there appeared to be no middle path. Thus, as the campaign went on, Negro suffrage occupied a more and more important position. Stevens, Wade, Sumner, Chase, Schurz, and Chandler were in favor of it. To many Northerners, it had been at first unthinkable, but more and more they became convinced. The nation urged full Negro suffrage and Negro civil rights, but opposed the exclusion of white leaders from office. The doctrine that this is a white man's government, and intended for white men only, is, as the Perrys profess it, as monstrous a doctrine as was ever concocted. To allow the states to reorganize on this basis, the nation added, will make the very name of American democracy a hissing and a byword among the nations of the earth. To have this theory of the nature of our government boldly thrust in our faces now, after the events of the last 4 years, by men who have come red-handed from the battlefield, and to whose garments the blood of our brothers and sons still clings, and to know that the president, who owes in part at least his ability to be president to the valor and blood of colored troops, concurs with them in this scandalous repudiation of democratic principles, are things which the country, we trust, will find it hard to bear. For a brief period, for the 7 mystic years that stretched between Johnson's swing round the circle to the panic of 1873, the majority of thinking Americans of the North believed in the equal manhood of Negroes. They acted accordingly with a thoroughness and clean-cut decision that no age which does not share that faith can in the slightest comprehend. They did not free draft animals, nor enfranchise guerrillas, nor welcome morons to Congress. They simply recognized black folk as men. The South called for war, said James Russell Lowell, and we have given it to her. We will fix the terms of peace ourselves, and we will teach the South that Christ is disguised in a dusky race. Then came, in 1873 to 1876, sudden and complete disillusion, not at Negroes, but at the world, at business, at work, at religion, at art. A bitter protest of Southern property reinforced Northern reaction, and while, after long years, the American world recovered in most matters, it has never yet quite understood why it could ever have thought that black men were altogether human. There were men in the South and former slaveholders who knew the truth and spoke it. They knew that there could be no salvation for the South in time or eternity until the former slave went forth as a man. But the entrenched intolerance of the South, coupled with the awful grief at the death of the flower of Southern manhood, let such prophets speak but few words. They spoke here and there in nearly every Southern state, but they were soon threatened into silence, and there prevailed a bitter hatred and cry for vengeance from people who could not brook defeat because they had been used to victory and had the slave-born habit of arrogance. For their grief, none had greater sympathy than the bulk of their former slaves. They served and even succored their former masters, and yet upon these and their fellows was eventually placed the whole wrath of the South, which it could not turn toward the North. And especially it fell upon those freedmen who felt their freedom, who were uplifted by new ambition, who showed the gathered resentment of 200 years of whipping, kicks, and cuffs. In fine, on them who had rolling in their ears God's great, deposuit potentes. He hath put down the mighty from their seats, and hath exalted them of low degree. After the final elections of 1866, the Republicans had 143 members in the House, and the Democrats 49. All states gave strong majorities to the Republican Party, except the border states of Maryland, Delaware, and Kentucky. In the South, Democratic candidates were universally successful. Not counting the South, the Republicans in the Senate had a 2/3 majority and nearly a 3/4 majority in the House. Through the winter of 1866 through 1867, notwithstanding the results of the elections of 1866, the South rejected the 14th Amendment. Virginia gave one vote in favor. North Carolina, 11 out of 148. South Carolina, one vote. Georgia, 2 out of 169. Alabama, 10 out of 106. Texas, 5. And Arkansas, 3. Florida, Mississippi, and Louisiana were unanimously against it. Thus the South defied Congress and demanded that the disfranchised Negro should be counted as bases of representation. The South was encouraged in this stand by the President. The governor of Alabama telegraphed him that the rejection of the 14th Amendment could be reconsidered by his state, but Johnson discouraged him. This increased the strength of the Republicans in the North. The President's message of December 4, 1866, with all the earmarks of Seward, was calm and skillful. He said that the war was ended, and that the nation should now proceed as a free, prosperous, and united nation. He had already informed Congress of his efforts for the gradual restoration of the states. All that remained now was the admission to Congress of loyal senators and representatives. While Congress had been considering this, the President had appointed various public officials, and the 13th Amendment had been passed. Yet Congress hesitated to admit the Southern states to representation, and after 8 months, only Tennessee had been admitted. He wished to leave the whole matter of suffrage to the states, and he was significantly silent on the black codes. The second session of the 39th Congress began December 3rd. The Senate asked for a report on the condition of the Southern states, since the President had said practically nothing about it. The President replied, December 19, 1866. As a result of the measures instituted by the executive, with the view of inducing a resumption of the functions of the states comprehended in the inquiry of the Senate, the people of North Carolina, South Carolina, Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, and Tennessee have reorganized their respective state governments and are yielding obedience to the laws and government of the United States with more willingness and greater promptitude than under the circumstances could reasonably have been anticipated. The proposed amendment to the Constitution, providing for the abolition of slavery forever within the limits of the country, has been ratified by each one of those states, with the exception of Mississippi, from which no official information has yet been received. And in nearly all of them, measures have been adopted or are now pending to confer upon freedmen rights and privileges which are essential to their comfort, protection, and security. In Florida and Texas, the people are making commendable progress in restoring their state governments, and no doubt it is entertained that they will, at an early period, be in a condition to resume all of their practical relations to the federal government. It is true that in some of the states the demoralizing effects of the war are to be seen in occasional disorders, but these are local in character, not frequent in occurrence, and are rapidly disappearing as the authority of civil law is extended and sustained. Perplexing questions were naturally to be expected from the great and sudden change in the relations between the two races, but systems are gradually developing themselves under which the freedman will receive the protection to which he is justly entitled, and by means of his labor make himself a useful and independent member of the community in which he has his home. The transubstantiation of Andrew Johnson was complete. He had begun as the champion of the poor laborer, demanding that the land monopoly of the Southern oligarchy be broken up so as to give access to the soil, South and West, to the free laborer. He had demanded the punishment of those Southerners who, by slavery and war, had made such an economic program impossible. Suddenly thrust into the presidency, he had retreated from this attitude. He had not only given up extravagant ideas of punishment, but he dropped his demand for dividing up plantations when he realized that Negroes would largely be beneficiaries. Because he could not conceive of Negroes as men, he refused to advocate universal democracy, of which, in his young manhood, he had been the fiercest advocate, and made strong alliance with those who would restore slavery under another name. This change did not come by deliberate thought or conscious desire to hurt. It was rather the tragedy of American prejudice made flesh. So that the man, born to narrow circumstances, a rebel against economic privilege, died with the conventional ambition of a poor white to be the associate and benefactor of monopolists, planters, and slave drivers. In some respects, Andrew Johnson is the most pitiful figure of American history, a man who, despite great power and great ideas, became a puppet, played upon by mighty fingers and selfish, subtle minds, groping, self-made, unlettered, and alone, drunk not so much with liquor as with the heady wine of sudden and accidental success. My wild soul waited on as falcons hover. I beat the reedy fins as I trampled past. I heard the mournful loon in the marsh beneath the moon. And then, with feathery thunder, the bird of my desire broke from the cover, flashing silver fire. High up among the stars I saw his pinions spire. The pale clouds gazed aghast as my falcon dropped upon him and gripped and held him fast. William Rose Benet.